In case anybody isn't, the city of Ashland, like a lot of municipalities, has an ordinance on the books that says that people cannot establish campsites on public property. And it's a little bit more nuanced than that. There's a rule, I think, for parks and a rule for non-parks public property. So there, a rule does exist. Also, a few years ago, the city of Boise, Idaho's prohibited camping ordinance was challenged in federal court. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Boise's was not constitutional. Boise's prohibited camping ordinance was more punitive than ours is. And so at the time, there was an idea with the city attorney that our prohibited camping ordinance is not really affected by the Boise decision. However, a year or so after that, the city of Grants Pass, had their prohibited camping ordinance challenged in federal court. Theirs was a lot more similar to ours than the Boise one was. That one was also ruled by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to be, by a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals abbreviated panel, not the full panel, but by a three-judge panel, was also ruled to be unconstitutional. So the end result of that is that, while our local ordinance has not been completely nullified, the current advice from the city's legal department is don't push that button unless you really, really have to, because we don't want ours to be just scuttled and then we're left with nothing. So there's another, before I go into the pending state legislation, the reason it's significant is that only a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit ruled on the Grants Pass ordinance is because Grants Pass, as I understand it, is appealing that decision to the entire Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So that might get adjusted at the appeals court level, and regardless of that decision, it might go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So everything is still very much in play and up in the air. We don't, what is true today, we don't know if it's going to be true 12 months or 24 months or 36 months from now. There's another state law that's going into effect in either June or July that says that local ordinances on prohibited camping have to be reasonable in their time, place, and manner restrictions. So all of this throws our prohibited camping ordinance into a little bit of limbo. The current camping situation that we have, a lot of people notice that they pop up in Triangle Park and then after a few days they go away, and then they pop up somewhere else and then they go away. One tool that we definitely do have is that there's a state law that says that if there's an illegal campsite on public property, the local authorities, that being us on behalf of the city, can post it for 72 hours removal. After 72 hours, we, the police department, can dismantle it. The people that are currently engaged in the camping protests have been good about clearing out before the 72 hours is up. The reason that it took longer than 72 hours to get to move them or to have them move out of Triangle Park, to be quite blunt about it, is because we screwed up and we didn't post it in time. I think everybody thought somebody else was doing it, and so we're being more deliberate about it now. There's a caveat that within the state law that says you have to give them 72 hours notice, that if there is other, or if there is unlawful activity taking place other than prohibited camping, then you can order the immediate removal of that campsite. And so one thing that we found is that, or one thing we realized, and this is a learning process for all of us, even those of us that are in the law enforcement world, we realized that there is also a prohibition on storing equipment and merchandise and personal property on sidewalks downtown. And so if they are storing that stuff on the plaza, which is downtown, which is a sidewalk or right of way, then that is an underlying illegal activity that can tell them they have to immediately remove it. So we're trying to make sure, and I don't say any of this in a manner that lacks compassion or sympathy to those people that are unhoused, but we're also trying to be responsive to complaints of people that don't want you know, Ashland to go the way of other cities on the West Coast. We're trying to make sure that we have, that we're using every avenue we have available to us in an appropriate way. One of the other things that I just want to make sure is at the forefront of this conversation is that the initial people that have, are participating in this camping protest are not doing it for a lack of stable housing being offered to them. They're doing it because they believe they have a right to camp anywhere they want to. And the police department has as much sympathy as anybody for, you know, the family, the mother, and really anybody that's unhoused and is living in the elements. We're not unsympathetic to that. We've tried everything we can to convince the people involved in this protest to accept lots of offers from lots of organizations for stable housing, and frankly, it's all been refused. So the last piece of this is that I've been working with Joe Lasar, the city manager, and Doug McGeary, the interim city attorney, and we've collectively crafted a potential new framework for addressing this issue, again, because we want to make sure that we're using every tool that we have at our disposal to address this ongoing situation and not let it, you know, further evolve or devolve into a tent city that is permanently in place. So there's hopefully some more information coming in the next few days to a week or so, but until Joe has a chance to review it and Doug has a chance to review it, I don't really want to speak to the possible details of that new framework, but I am happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions?
Let me just say as well, as a city councilor, we've been getting lots and lots of emails, we've got a couple dozen emails about it, of course, we've had some, Joe has talked with us a couple times about some opportunities to try to come up with some permanent shelter solutions, not just for the winter, but also for all year round in emergencies. That hasn't come forward yet. And on this issue, I've been reaching back to every single person who has written in, and I've had, I guess, probably 15 or so conversations. Echo met me in one of the conversations at a coffee shops or by phone. So we are trying to respond. I'm not really able to say as much more than Ty, really. I explain what the situation is. And they always end up the conversation asking the person who's concerned about it, would you want the police to go in and bust up the camp? And not a single person has said that that's what they would want. So I think the way I see it is putting it in that sort of way is let's figure out what are the opportunities that we have that doesn't involve busting up the camp, because that's not what we want.
I have a question, and this is a subjective one, but so I'm just putting it out there. Do you feel like the people that are turning down opportunities for more stable housing that are living in a tent triangle, it's a lifestyle issue, or is it more of a political statement that they're trying to make?
Well, one of them for sure, it's a lifestyle choice. And the reason I say that confidently is because it's right on the sign that he flies in front of his tent. I think that, and I'm not trying to pass, assign any judgment or convey any judgment with this. I think with some of the other people, they've been offered stable housing in Medford, and they say, no, we want to stay in Ashland. Then that becomes a whole other conversation about do people under such dire circumstances get to dictate, you know, where they find stability, or do they take what's given to them? But that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah, thank
you. I just want to say that I live in that neighborhood, and my teens walk through that park to get to school. Some teens have been seen smoking something with the unhoused people, and an officer I spoke with confirmed there are hard drugs being used in that park, harder than marijuana or alcohol. He didn't say what, so I don't know what that means. Fentanyl, heroin, I don't know. And then the other thing that's being reported is the feces and the urine in the alley, which is causing a health hazard.
I certainly am not oblivious to the notion that there's hard drugs being used, and we're trying to get the officers as much as they're able to check in and look for the evidence of that, and if they can substantiate that, then use that as the trigger to have a campsite removed immediately. Unfortunately, you know, we can't be everywhere all at once, but I don't doubt what you're saying.
Yeah, and it's so hard because this is where the NIMBY thing really gets tested, right? It's not that I'm saying not in my neighborhood. I'm saying I draw the line at poop and hard drugs.
Yeah.
You know, if they're
adjacent to the high school.
Adjacent to the high school, exactly. I want them to be safe. I really want the unhoused to have a safe place. And I'm just not sure where that is. That's going to work for all community members. Because I mean, anyway, I'm preaching to the choir here. You know everything that's been going on there, but I'm not sure everyone else in the committee does.
One more question. If there's a 3-day window there before you can remove them, sort of thing, is the city or anybody else willing to put up a porta potty?
You know, that's kind of straying into Joe's area, and as Councilor Kaplan stated, part of the conversation is designating a spot as more of a permanent location. I think I heard you say something like that. And I know that Joe recognizes the need to, if we're going to say that this is the camping spot, that there needs to be some sanitary facilities there. So, but that's kind of Joe's part of the exploration, not mine so much.
Rich.
I'm really in favor of the Boise decision, so I'm hoping that continues up there. But the thing that to me is the biggest threat is the division in the community. And I mean, I go by places that it looks pretty normal to me. So it's kind of like a Rorschach test for people in a way, because many people just see it as completely unacceptable. What it's going to do is really put our community in a place where the work that we're trying to do is going to have a really harder time. So I'm kind of in the Joe realm here in terms of what is practical to do that doesn't violate the Boise decision but helps with some of the questions that get raised up in just a kind of a neutral way. It doesn't have to be it's not an advocate for anything other than trying to make the situation work. So I don't know if you can communicate that with the administration, but I think we really lose if the community gets divided into really bad positions on this.
If I can step in here, I think this is a place where we as a committee can have a role to understand what the city is dealing with and what they're trying to do, at least to the extent that we understand it at this moment. But I think I can say confidently, just given the history, that you know they're moving forward in the most humane way that's legal within the parameters that they have. But to really take the time to listen to citizens who are upset about it, and also to just, you know, we can play a role in just like having people hear all the sides of the conversation, which has the effect of diffusing things often. So I just want to encourage us that's the ambassador role that I think we can play.
Linda, can I?
Absolutely.
Yeah, tag on to that. I think I agree completely with that. And one of the topics that I discussed with Joe last week was the possibility of using the Housing and Human Services Committee as a forum for that, for public input, and for thinking through the issue of providing some advice to council. I did not take that to council and ask if council wanted to give direction to the Housing and Human Services Committee to play that role, but I could do that if this committee were interested in playing that. Would then prioritize, I know you've got a work plan that you talked about a couple of sessions ago. This, I think, would go up to the top of that work plan if you were to take this on.
It's a challenging thing, because I feel like what we will hear from citizens will put us in the position of, okay, we've heard you, but, you know, we can't do anything more than the police department.
We also got to bring the school into this, because it's been laid out, and so I'd like to hear from them and have them be part of the solution.
And what are the current avenues for voicing community members unhoused and not voicing at the council itself?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. They can always come. There's a 15 minutes of time on the council agenda every business meeting where anybody can come and talk about anything that's not on the agenda. If it's on the agenda, there's another time for talking about that as well. So there's that. What I'm suggesting is something a little bit more extensive that would take advantage of this body, but then, you know, process some of that and then, well, hear it, process it, think about it, and make recommendations. Because, you know, we talked about the possibility of a more permanent camping spot, but I think one of the questions is camping really the solution that we want at this point? Living in a tent in this time of year is not a great alternative either. You've got limited opportunities for, you know, better shelter. Even a tent, a permanent city-sanctioned urban campground, best practice is that it's staffed 24 hours a day. It's got to have certain, you know, we of course have sanitary facilities. It's not cheap. The experience of Rogue Retreat, you know, indicates that that's the case. So is that, you know, a sensible approach to this, response to this, or is some other sort of having to provide 24 hours, and then we get into this whole longer discussion about allocation of resources. So it's a big, it's a big issue.
I'm gonna give this about 3 more minutes, because we have a huge agenda today.
I've been a longtime advocate for the unhoused here in Ashland, and I fully support providing appropriate shelter for unhoused folks. I had a conversation with someone who has been sort of monitoring the pellet shelters. He attempted to talk to some of the people in Triangle Park and found it almost impossible. It quickly escalated into us and them, and he felt like this is a more complex problem. And as I listened to him talk and looked at my own personal issues, I think location is everything. And I think providing an appropriate camping space somewhere away from children, with proper sanitation, and you're right, it's not cheap. It would cost money to provide some oversight. But I think that where they are doing this is inappropriate, and it's complex because I think there are mental health issues involved also. I don't know how to solve it, and I don't think it will be easy. And I think of myself as an advocate also in the community, but I think this is a really complex situation.
Yes.
Echo. Well, and I was just going to pretty much say what Heidi said. You know, there's so many, everybody in this room knows, that there are so many reasons that folks are unhoused and living in tents. And tents end up being the extreme far end of a spectrum of housing. Not a good long-term solution. But for some percentage of people, it's a first step if it enhances their sense of safety and control. And then there's the issues with addiction and health, and other health issues and mental health. And so we all know what the problems are. And we all also pretty much have good ideas about what solutions are. And it's never going to be perfect. And so what we end up doing too often in this society is letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. And so we constantly, I think, have to remind ourselves as a community, as a council, and on this committee, that we can make some difference. It will never feel like enough. But we have to try, because not trying is not an option.
Thank you, Todd, for coming.
No problem.
I appreciate you being here.
20-second question to our liaison. Do you understand that we have then, as a, you're not a commission anymore, a committee, basically asked the city to be part of the solution, and you were sort of asking that.
I was asking, yeah, I don't hear.
Did you hear an answer from us that was positive?
I don't know, I'd like to hear something a little bit more clear, because I recognize it's a complicated thing for this group as well. I heard some sense that you'd like to do this, but I didn't hear, you know, an answer from the committee.
I feel like we need more conversation before we're going to get to a definitive thing, and we simply do not have the time today to do that.
And we can add it to an agenda, like maybe the agenda, and then in advance of that, I can send information if you guys have any input. Does that sound okay? Or we could even do it in May, early May, or later?
I'm happy to help out any way I can. If you want to invite me back, I'm more than happy to come back.
Thank you so much for coming.
No problem.
My only reaction is April, May, I mean, the problem is.
Budget.
No, the problem is now. Problem is a month ago.
Well, we can, I mean, if a subcommittee wanted to work on it, we could do a subcommittee to come back. Does that, I don't know. Or I'm going to call it a work group, because subcommittees require minutes.
Subcommittee's a different thing.
Well, we're talking about something that's a public meeting anyway. You want the public to be there, so.
I just don't want to take minutes.
All right, let's come back to this at the end. We'll spend some time thinking about how we want to approach this. I want to ask the people who are available for public forum to just take a couple of minutes to share what you came here to talk with us about.
And you're welcome to come up here if you'd like, or you can stay, whichever.
Maybe we could split it, we could see it over here.
Yeah, or good.
Okay, my name's Alex Reed, and I'm here today with two other volunteers from a little project called Laundry Love, Linda Smith and John Colleen. And we're here to ask for some advice and suggestions. Laundry Love has been in the community for almost 8 years now, and our mission is to assist people of no and a low income, both, so that they can launder their clothing and their bedding. And we have been at Henry's Laundromat for 7.5 years, and we were evicted on February 6th, the coldest month of the year. And of course, it's a time when unhoused people need to launder their sleeping bags, bedding. We are looking for a new home, both temporary and permanent. We went immediately to our dear friends, Aura, knocked on their door, and I'm grateful for all they do here. We're going to be doing some laundry at the shower trailer, but it won't be very much. It's a little space, little machines, but hopefully we can help people who are there for showers also with washing clothes, at least some of them. But we are also looking for a place where we could put 3 washing machines and 3 dryers. I hope someday there will be a building here in Ashland that does everything like warming, cooling, emergency, all of those things. And I think that there's some thought going on with that. And it seems you probably already thought that would be a perfect place for showers and laundry machines. Okay, so we got the permanent one figured out. From here to there. From here to there. Just any ideas you might have as to places, spaces that would be open to that. I will say, in our favor, we kept it really clean because there were always volunteers present, and there were no cigarette butts or anything else laying on the ground during the hours that we were there. So we're pretty good neighbors. And there seems to be, sometimes there is sentiment against the people without homes, but everybody seems to get the idea that laundry is important for cleanliness so that people can get jobs, people can go to job interviews, apply for housing, and just be welcome and feel okay by themselves. The motto for Laundry Love that started in Ventura in 2002, they asked a gentleman on the street who went by the name of T-Bone how people might come alongside his life and help. And he said, "I think if I wore clean clothes, people would treat me like a human being." So he's a co-founder of Laundry Love at the national level. So if you have any questions about that project, we're totally volunteer. And
did I want to add something out?
Addressed it well.
Can you give us your phone number so we can get that into the minutes so that people can be
Lovely, yeah.
Sending you information.
But you don't like to take minutes.
I'm taking them right now.
It's 707-499-9146. Linda, did you want to add something?
No, I've probably been volunteering for Laundry Love a couple years, and years ago, with Rich, I think we did some fundraising for Laundry Love at our church, and it is a wonderful, wonderful program, and like Alex said, everybody really behaved well when we were there, kept it real clean, and we were sorry to lose that spot.
Yeah.
There are other circumstances not related to us, so we're hoping to find something soon so that people can, we had a lot of very, very happy people leaving the old laundromat with clean clothes.
Yeah. Oh,
it's a fabulous service.
Maybe we should say that our last month we served 52 people and we put $688 into the machines that month.
Yeah.
So we
thank you.
Anyway, who has a nice big garage?
Thank you so much.
Okay, so we can just sort of leave that if there are some ideas as people would call.
Yeah,
thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, and I just encourage people to even before you get the minutes in the mail, you can call and get the number and pass on information. It's a low time of year for hotels. We have lots of laundry facilities.
Oh,
that was my first thought.
And I think with volunteers, because there are a lot of less dedicated people that would be at a motel to make sure everything was going well, that things weren't put in the machines it shouldn't be. So I think it could be a really good program as an alternative place to do it.
You're welcome to stay for the rest of the meeting or take off if you need to.
Thanks
for being here. I would like to move on to approving the minutes at the last meeting. I was not here, so they were informative, but I don't have any idea about corrections. Heidi?
I move that we approve the minutes from February 23rd, 2023 minutes as presented.
I have a second.
Second. Oh, you didn't. I'm sorry. In favor? Yes. Our big yes, Mary?
I have two extra agendas if anyone needs agendas. I just wanted to let you know.
Sure. The one.
The bulk of our meeting is going towards the community development block grant applications, and we have people here to talk about those. Linda Reed. Do you
yes.
have a? Do you want to take them in the service ones first, and then the capital?
Yeah, I think you wanted to. Bob wanted to.
I need to leave.
Yeah.
I shouldn't because I don't need. To, I shouldn't participate in this conversation or be present in this conversation because I'm going to be in the city council. And your recommendation goes to the city council. So I understand that long-standing practice is that the council liaison doesn't come to this meeting. So,
So do you have things on the remaining part of the agenda you really want to
Well, just what if you wanted a council liaison report, I'd be willing to do that, you know,
right.
Briefly or
let's do that quickly before we go ahead then.
Okay, great, thanks. Well, one aspect of it was we just got a report on the extreme weather shelter, temporary extreme weather shelter, and it probably came from Linda, so Linda knows these numbers better than I do.
Well, not off the top of my head.
what Joe told us this last week was that there were 10 days left, funding for 10 days, 10 more days of funding, of which 4 have been used now for the next 2 days, so there'll be 6 more. So that's where we're sitting in terms of funding. He told us that there was usage of between 11 and 34 on any given night.
11 and 34,
and an average
of
24
or 25 every day.
And it's now been called this week through Sunday, is that
through
right?
Thursday through Sunday.
That's the 4 days, and just 6 days after that. The other thing is just to mention that the budget, we had a discussion of budget priorities. You guys were going into the budget discussion, the biennial budget from 2023 to 2025. And so this is giving direction to the staff in preparing that budget because of overall overarching priorities. And there was a lot of consensus from the council members. We each spoke individually, but I think many of us said the same things. The priorities have to do with what we're calling now, after Rick Bailey's term, attainable housing, instead of just affordable housing, attainable housing, and affordability, including specifically, this is one of, as you know, one of my additions to this, is progressive utility rates. Climate and wildfire risk was another thing that people came very, very strongly. And then economic development and diversification, including some sense of taking advantage of our broader environment in the region through trails and other kinds of recreation activities that we're actually in place. Anyway, the main thing was the first item, I think, for this group. We specifically mentioned, I think actually was captured in the final as well, the housing production strategy is a priority, and not just approving it, but moving on to, you know, rapid implementation in the first next 2 years, we can talk about planning. That's my report.
And I, you don't have to answer this now because it probably isn't answered yet, but I know that the question has come up, not necessarily from this group, but eventually, about housing trust, the continued dedication of housing trust funds to, or marijuana tax funds to the housing trust fund. And then also, this year would normally be our social service grant cycle, and we have not heard whether the city has any intention of setting aside funding for that grant fund.
I haven't heard.
Those are the two things that I think at some point we'll have to get some.
The city manager will present his budget to the budget committee. The budget committee is now complete in next month, 27th. I think it's the 27th of April is the first meeting, so it'll happen just before that. So then there'll be some
information. Yeah, great.
Because the way this works, it's the city manager who presents it, making the budget balance, and then there's discussion within the citizens budget committee on any kind of shifts or there's some recommendations to the council before the council takes it up in June. There'll be five citizens budget committee meetings, which is unusual in Oregon. It's usually one or two. Okay.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay, thanks, Linda.
Okay. So before we get started, I do generally go public service, and I generally recommend alphabetical order because, you know, that's easy. But we should also go around the room and state whether we have any conflicts of interest or any perceived conflicts of interest, just for the record.
That includes whether you sit on boards of any of these organizations or advisory committees.
Or work for one.
Yeah. Or have an ongoing income contract. We apparently do not, so let's move forward. So that would make Maslow first.
You want me to come up here?
Would you come and sit?
Yeah, yeah, yes. I'm happy to.
Oh, this chair is ready, so I feel like I'm really at the top here.
They're all very tricky.
That's fine.
Sorry.
Don't worry.
These chairs are complicated.
All office chairs seem to be complicated for some reason. Should I get started?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you want to go there first?
Oh, no, I'm good. Okay. Although when we walked by with them earlier,
maybe,
I could, like,
you're
smell
done,
it.
When you're done, you can talk.
That's
why I'm
that
way.
I know. But I'm not
open. So we've had an opportunity to read the proposal, so can you just give us a brief overview and then leave a little time for questions, because I think people would probably have some in their questions as they read it.
Yeah, absolutely. About how much time do I have?
You know, I actually scheduled 10 minutes, which I assumed included questions, because there's only three. So
sure.
I know sometimes.
That's generous now that we were like 20 minutes behind schedule.
Yeah,
so
that's
true.
Sure.
Like 7 or 8, that would be
better. Yeah, not a problem. I'll give a little overview of our programs and then kind of talk about some my name is Cheyenne Nichols. I'm one of the program managers at Maslow Project. I used to be a case manager for the Ashland School District for a really long time. I first started in 2013, so some familiar faces here in the room, which is nice. And so it's easy also for me to talk about the Ashland program because it's very sort of near and dear to my heart. I've been here for a long time. But just really want to kind of emphasize our wraparound support services that we offer here at Maslow Project and the way that we're able to really see a lot of success in our youth and our families. And that, I think, one of the key things is us, like both the model in which we do it and where we are integrated into the community. So first and foremost, being partnered with our schools allows us to provide the stabilization support, the case management, and outreach as well. So we're really advocating for students who are experiencing houselessness. We identify students that way under the McKinney-Vento law, and that means they get specific rights and to reduce their barriers to be able to stay in school and be successful in school. So it's a big part of what we are doing integrated into our school system. And then just making sure that they're getting all basic needs met first and foremost. So food, clothing, hygiene supplies. We actually just had a kid this week who kind of dropped off the mat for a little bit, got him back in, kept texting him. We were like, what's going on? He's like, the washer went down at the place that I'm staying at. He's been couch surfing. And he's like, oh, my clothes were just so dirty. I was too embarrassed to show up to school. And so we were just able to give him some brand new clothes. And, you know, that like speaks to itself, you know, how important those basic needs are. The case management piece is really offering more intensive support for youth and families and on their self-sufficiency and goals, and it's all client-led goals. So, you know, whether they want to be connected to healthcare, mental health care, find housing, sometimes get into TLP or a shelter, or maybe just get their GED or graduate, whatever the goal is, we're able to help walk alongside them and kind of navigate that path. And then as far as like approach, one of my favorite parts of how we offer services is just a really client-centered boots on the ground model. So we do outreach, we're integrated in the community, we are able to meet our clients at a park or wherever they're staying in our schools and sort of just like meet their creative need. I had a student, I sort of filled the case management role for a little bit this year as well. And I had a student that I was working with who was in the hospital earlier this year for a suicide attempt, and I was able to check in at school with him alongside of his mental health provider to check in on his safety plan. One of his safety like coping strategies was to write, so I was able to get him a journal. He's also had some goals around not purging, and so I was able to get him a blender so he started to make like give him recipes to make smoothies, and it helped him get the nutrition that he needed. So really grateful that we're allowed to really meet each individual student and family where they're at and kind of provide that support. This year in Ashland School District, we've had like almost 18 and a couple more came in this week, like 20 unaccompanied youth. That's high for Ashland. Historically, that's high, almost 20 unaccompanied youth. We do have 17 seniors. I think maybe one of them might be a fifth year, but otherwise we're looking at an almost 100% graduation rate, which is really, really awesome. The national average for McKinney-Vento homeless students is, the national grad rate is 58%. So our district, we're looking at almost 100% this year, which is really cool. Yay. That stuff gets me excited. last year we served 167 total clients, and we were able to house 15 families in our new permanent supportive housing program in Snowberry 2, which has been really incredible, and everybody's really been thriving in that program. And then just kind of some statistics to leave you all with. We know that McKinney-Vento homeless youth are 2 times as likely to become hungry, 2 times more likely to be absent from school, and 7 times more likely to attempt suicide. It's not even suicidal ideation, which I think is significant. And that lacking a high school diploma is the leading predicting factor for adult chronic homelessness. So really, again, speaks to the criticalness of having that early education support, intervention support. And yeah, there's a student that we worked with as well who, when I first met her, she was living in like an abandoned pod on somebody's property, and ended up graduating a couple years later. We nominated her for one of our scholarships, and she got to buy all of this gear because she had an internship doing trail conservation work. And it was really, she was so excited. It was so awesome. She's in her second year at the U of O. She's an environmental science major now. And we're still in touch. But like seeing that progression and her going into higher education, and she got a job at the place that she did her internship with, and then now goes back every summer to coach kids who are doing that, which is really cool. So a lot of good stories to kind of, you know, present the work that we do. So that's what I have for you today.
Questions?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have one. What other category is there other than unaccompanied youth? If they're accompanied, who are they accompanied by?
By parents. We serve all youth 0 to 21. So students can be homeless with their families as well.
The whole family.
Yeah, the whole family. Yeah. And the McKinney-Vento definition of homeless is different than the HUD definition of homeless. So it's the definition is anyone who lacks a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence. So it also captures those folks who are doubled up due to economic hardship, which really is like the invisible homeless population. You know, we don't see that. It's not the transient crew that runs through our community. Yeah.
Rich? I really like the grant. I love grants written like that. It's terrific. And to see the growth along with the statistics is really good. But the one thing that I thought was new, because you have the people at Snowberry, and
sure,
if you have people in the high school with your own center, but I was also wondering about the mobile part. Is that just the person with a car, or is there a more of a program? And I'm thinking, are you related to what is now the 988 program? That we have a CAHOOTS program,
yeah,
in Jackson County that goes out, and it's growing, and it's going to get way bigger, and they're fed in by a new 988 number. But have you followed that? Are you connected into that?
Yeah, we aren't a part of that specific like initiative, but we have folks that we're connected with. Our outreach team is a separate crew of people, and we do outreach for all the way from Ashland over to Cave Junction, Butte Falls, Prospect. So we cover quite a bit of area that we do street outreach. And that looks like throwing on a backpack and we walk along the Greenway, we go downtown, we go here up into the parks or to the library. There are certain hubs as well in more of our rural communities that our outreach team goes to.
I'm just on this, but
yeah,
no. how do if you're out there on the street, how do y'all identify? I mean, the CAHOOTS people have little cute CAHOOTS.
Yeah.
And everybody's loved them. But you're just like, somebody has to just like as an adult, just check in with folks.
Yeah, that's a great question. We also we all have Maslow gear. So we have hats, we have sweatshirts. We have our Maslow van is marked. It says Maslow Project on it. It's black. So, you know, the word travels quickly. So usually they know we're coming and they see us, so they come to us. And just kind of that accountability of them knowing that we're going to be here and what we have, and we have socks and food and whatever else they might need. And they really kind of end up coming to us, yeah, when we're out there. Yeah.
Are any of your families Almeda fire survivors?
Yeah, many of them.
Kathy.
Yeah, our case manager for Phoenix Talent School District, who, like,
okay.
We were right on that when that happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're partnering with them, because I know.
Oh yeah. 100%.
So many of those parents who were displaced struggled so hard to keep their kids in the Phoenix Talent School District, because
yes,
it gave their kids some sense of stability.
Absolutely.
Even though some of them are still technically homeless.
Yeah.
I would love to have, if I can put on a slightly different hat.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I would love to have that number of those families that fall into that category because of another thing that I do, not on this committee.
Oh, sure.
But on another thing, I would like to share that with the long-term recovery group.
Yeah, I don't know that exact
number
off the
like,
top of my head, but I can
call me,
follow
email
up with
me,
you. Absolutely.
Let Linda know.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
Anything. I think that would be very helpful for that group.
Any other questions? Heidi?
I had a question about the Snowberry 2 housing units. Yeah, 15 housing units.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to tour that, I think, a year or two ago. It looked fabulous. fabulous.
Yeah, they're really nice.
Are they permanent supportive housing units? I mean, does the same family stay in that unit?
Yeah, good question. So when we make the referral, we have this partnership with Housing Authority, who is the property management owner of those units. When we make a referral, they get a project-based voucher. So that means that they're also agreeing to case management with us and participating in our case management program. After a year, if they wanted to, they could convert that project-based voucher and say take it to a different house and somewhere else. And the theory is that that will happen, right, and open up more opportunities for those units to become available, and then we can move families in. Part of the problem is that there's not a lot of places to take that voucher to right now, so it's not happening as much. But yeah, so it kind of starts with one type of voucher, and then it can transfer to a different kind of voucher where they can get.
So pretty much the people that are there will stay there, and do the families, do the kids age out? And like, I saw one of the legislature things was to raise the age to 24.
Yeah.
Before.
It can impact their eligibility for that unit based on their family size. And that would be true for any Section 8 voucher. Yeah.
So they could age out of the program.
Yeah.
And then the whole family would have to do it.
Yeah, unless it's been a year and they can convert their voucher to a different kind of voucher, and if they still, or maybe move to like a different unit, like if it was a single mom, maybe with a 18-year-old kid, and a studio became available, maybe she could move there if kiddo was moving out. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, please.
Can I ask a budget question really fast?
Yes.
I understand that our funds for this category of project is very limited. Is that right, Linda? Mm-hmm. So if we don't give you the full amount requested, what would happen?
We will be probably applying for lots of other grants.
Just checking that little factoid.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome to stay, or you need to leave, feel free.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Shai. That's, I think you guys are awesome.
Oh, thank you.
All right, Cass, are you ready?
Yes.
Hi everyone. Hi, I'm Cass. I know you all, but I'm the executive director for Aura. Thanks so much for having us here and giving us this opportunity, and it's good to see you all. So for this ask, before I move into that, I kind of wanted to give you the high level. I know we just spoke recently, but we're so near finishing our construction, we are talking to our community about the fact that we are a social service hub, that the services that we're providing for our community are addressing so many things through the low barrier shelter, which is a 52-room shelter, along with that walk-in resource center, which we are really the only low barrier walk-in resource center that serves our community, and we're seeing about 40 to 50 people a day, and we're doing about 40 showers a week at the laundry shower trailer. So folks come in, they work alongside the navigators, and they can work with the navigator every week for the rest of their lives if they want. Many people that are our chronic unhoused community members receive services and come in and build those relationships with the navigators. Similar after people are going out of the shelter and moving into permanent housing, which since we've opened in April of 21 between the resource center and the shelter, we've gotten 145 people permanently housed. Yay. So our model is
like
working.
70.
Our model is working. Our model is working, and you know, we'll have the data to look back on. We participate in the HMIS, which is the data capture system for our continuum of care. But having that emergency shelter and the walk-in resource center and the ability, even after people are housed, to come back in and work alongside the navigators on other things to remove their barriers is proving to be very, it's working. So we have 10 navigators, we have bilingual, bicultural navigation, and we actually are now have our outreach navigator that's working with our Spanish-speaking population and meeting them places in the community where they need help with social disability or social security. So she's out and about in our community now and working with our Spanish-speaking population. And we also have our front office staff is bilingual, bicultural. We are nearing finish with La Clinica, so La Clinica will be operational soon, and they will be providing mental health services and medical health services out of the resource center. They'll have their own little mini federally qualified health center. And our community partner room is now operational. So that's a place where community partners can come, addictions recovery center, credit counseling, OHSU School of Nursing, you name it. The opportunities are endless for a community partner to come in and utilize that space. And then people coming in through the resource center and people coming in through the shelter can access those services. So continuing to lower the barriers. So what I'm asking for today is $27,884 to support resource navigation. All the services that we provide, and much like all the other not-for-profits, means that we're going out and asking for grants. At this point, we're managing about 40 grants. We're grant heavy. We're in the middle of a campaign growing our constituency to increase those unrestricted dollars. But for the services that we're providing for our community, that's kind of what we're out shouting from the rooftops, is that we are providing a really unique service for our community. And so to pay all those resource navigators, we're out looking for grants.
Questions for Cass?
Will you speak to the situation around the availability of HUD housing versus the grants? I know you've had to lean so heavily on the grants now to pay first and last and monthly rents for people to get them into stable housing. Has it become necessary 100% for grants, or are there still Section 8 homes and apartments available?
So it is a little more difficult. We do have the relationships. We're working with, 55 community partners, landlords, commercial property management, Pacific, Siskiyou, all the property managers, private landlords. About half the people are ready with their Section 8 housing voucher, their emergency housing voucher. So we're able to get people housed. It is more difficult. Sometimes they do need to go to the greater Jackson County. Sometimes we have to help them port their voucher to the coast, or if they want to go somewhere else, Josephine County. The grants. So if I want to pass through those barrier reduction dollars to pay somebody's deposit and first 3 months, some of that came when we were passing through all the COVID money. We passed through $2 million of federal dollars to keep people housed and get people housed, over 500 families in Ashland and Talon. And so those dollars, when I want to do that, I've got to go ask for the grant to award those dollars, or reach out to community partners, faith-based organizations, St. Vincent de Paul, United Way, other people that are helping us pay somebody's rent. And we're also participating now in Tina Kotek's state of emergency and part of the countywide response and decision about how we can help increase shelter beds, pass through funding for rapid rehousing and rental assistance. Did that answer your question?
Kind of. It was a very complex answer. And I'm just curious, maybe the percentage of each, and that I wasn't clear. So what percentage of housing that you place people in is grant based, and what percentage is HUD, which is essentially a grant, but
I'm gonna have to get that for you. I don't know the exact percentage.
I'm just
percentage.
Curious, because so many times I'm touting you on Facebook and people say, there's no Section 8 housing, how can Aura help me when there's nothing? And I just want to give
but
them
there,
the facts.
And there is. I mean, it's tighter, but there is, and it's more difficult. But those relationships the navigators have and are to be able to reach out to get people housed, that's the relationship piece that works. So, but I can get you the exact breakdown of those numbers.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And this might be a distinction too, that during the pandemic, there was emergency rapid rehousing vouchers
that people were given that was made available above the normal vouchers that we get as a county.
Yes.
And to be clear for everyone, Section 8 housing is two things. One are project-based vouchers, which are vouchers that belong to a specific unit. If you live in that unit, you receive the subsidy, which is what Cheyenne was saying. And then there's something called portable vouchers, which is the Section 8 waiting list. Because when you get on the Section 8 waiting list, it isn't necessarily for a project-based unit. That's a separate application to that apartment complex that has the project-based vouchers. If you get on the Section 8 waiting list that is 3 to 4 years long, you get what's called a portable voucher, which you can use in any apartment unit or rental unit, housing unit, that will accept the voucher and is within that income range. And so I think those rapid rehousing vouchers that you got may not have been in affordable housing complexes or even complexes that have project-based vouchers, but were community-owned, mm-hmm. landlord-owned, mm-hmm. and operated units.
Can
that
I
you
take
cultivated.
That?
It's me, Shia.
That's the right answer.
I'm recording.
Oh, you're navigators.
Yes.
Cultivating
this
relationships
is why we need resource navigators.
Yeah, and I think what I'm coming up
and
across
Linda's brain.
In the community, there's a perception that Section 8 housing has run out, and I think part of it is people feel discouraged because it takes so long to build those relationships, and it requires a lot of showing up on their part, which some people are have varying degrees of ability to do.
And after you get the voucher, you have to find the housing that is also very difficult.
And that's where working with a navigator who's sort of established relationships can help.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you also have to provide sometimes some security deposit assistance to allow for that barrier? And you do too, for barrier removal for a harder or more riskier tenant.
Yes.
Yeah, so sometimes double the deposit.
Even though, like, that's not really.
Right.
Legal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's also not, you know, it's not legal to turn somebody down for a Section 8 voucher, but we all know that that happens as well.
Right. When the residents at the Aura complex time out, like after 6 months, they must leave, and you take the most needy cases from the whole county, how many of those people that get housing at Aura actually stay in Ashland, and how many spread out into the larger community?
So we were just talking about this today when I was racing over from our staff meeting here. If our guest identifies Ashland as their home, many times they're very clear that they just want to be housed in Ashland. And so the guests that we serve coming from Ashland, pretty much they're getting that we're finding housing for them in Ashland. Of the folks that have come through from Medford, who we capture data on, and they identify Medford as their home, then those folks were usually, they're going back to Medford into housing.
I would assume there's more housing available outside of Ashland,
yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, and sometimes folks who are just ready and they want to get housed, they'll go to Medford.
I wonder if we could move to the capital application.
Sure. So, I said we were nearing the end of our $1.6 million renovation budget, which was to install an elevator and a fire suppression system, 780 accessible bathrooms, a whole new air return system, dot lock system, heating and air units, other contingencies we've discovered along the way, and we don't have a commercial kitchen. So I have 52-room shelter, and I'm purchasing meals on an average, you know, you can go up to, but we have a $260,000 a year food budget. I would really like to have a kitchen for our community. For our congregate dining area, currently we're not congregate dining. We're still having those meals, and staff are going to deliver meals to guests in their room. And we're ready to congregate dine. And then when you have congregate dining, and we have the Unitarians coming in on Thursdays, which we're so grateful for them, They're, you know, they can bring in into the room that connects to that congregate dining area and bring meals, and but they can't wash their dishes there, and they can't come in and utilize a kitchen. And when I say commercial kitchen, I'm really, kitchen means you've got a thermometer in your fridge, you're not washing the hands in the same sink that you're, you know, it's not a big, huge commercial kitchen. I mean, it's not a, what am I trying to say? Commercial kitchen doesn't mean, for instance, that we're opening up a restaurant is what I'm saying. but it does mean that it provides that that ability for folks to come in, utilize the space, conserve as conserve other uses if need be. We need a kitchen.
So the idea is this is going to be a container that's adjacent to the common area?
Yes, and we're doing the permitting and going through all that and looking at things, so it would either be adjacent or it would be at the other end of the property.
Well, this is the best CDBG thing I can think of. I mean, it really fits, and it's something that keeps on giving because you can keep on cooking, but you're saving $100,000 a year under this. I mean, so like, it's just like, well, okay, we don't have to spend that extra $100,000 as a community. We can just commercialize it. But I was wondering, because I read all the questions about whether it's in a floodplain or not, and those other things. I mean, can we just skip over that and do it? Or
I was wondering about the floodplain too.
I mean, I just want it to happen, but those were the questions that I had. Was is this a container that comes in, or is just prefab something that comes in? That's my wife.
So you can buy prefab, and of course, as an organization, just by the by, everything that we have installed in our building has been electric. There were already existing gas heaters that brand new to heat that big, huge indoor pool. The only thing that's gas right now is this huge $40,000 commercial gas dryer. So we're gonna wait for those gas things to poop out, and then we'll look towards, you know, the three times expensive electric. But to your point, what was your point?
I think it's a great thing.
Yes.
I'm worried about the floodplain issue,
yes,
because otherwise we just do it.
Right.
And then the other question, if it's kind of portably and comes in, can't we just move it out of the floodplain or something?
So right now, steps that we're working on with John Fields, our general contractor, and Jerome White in the city, Brandon at the city, are to look at the 100-year, floodplain, the wetland overlay, the permitting, which is, you know, part of everything that we're getting in the works right now. And so the container can be built off-site and all done with electric appliances and things like that. And then when we decide, okay, where does it go, we need a site plan to say, okay, it's going to go here, and here's our water, sewer, and electric, or here's how we're going to solve for this, so it may be out here, maybe here. And you're right, regardless of whether we buy it prefab or have them do it off-site and bring it in, it just comes in on a crane, and they set it down, and it can be moved again. So even as, you know, our organization could look to how are we going to use the back of that property? Because everybody's like, huh, could you, you know, permanent support housing or whatever, extreme weather shelter. Let's just pick this up and move it over.
So I have a number of questions. Can I answer? Okay. I was worried about the floodplain issue too, because I know what's happened with displaced mobile home folks in town in Phoenix who discovered that their insurance costs became prohibitive because their particular site turned out to be in a flood zone / flood plain. And Kathy's an expert on this stuff because she's lived it. And so I know how it's tripped up folks in those communities. So I'm a little worried about getting it resurveyed for the flood plain and how that might delay. We won't know that for a while, but I just know it's happened.
So the good news, I hear, yes, And the good news is, we have a big piece of property. And so whether it's, you know, whether it's going to work for it to be adjacent on that side, or whether it comes back, you know, over to the high side, we have options.
And what square footage are you hoping for?
And it depends where, when it comes right down to it. They're 10 by 20 or 10 by 40.
Okay, that's a fairly decent size room, yeah. Like this.
Yeah, I mean, you get a, I mean, except for it's like.
Okay, so we're not talking a little tiny galley kitchen or something.
Yeah, it's full size.
I also noticed that Bowley and David Bacon applies.
Yes.
And that's been an interesting issue with another affordable housing project up in Medford. That got resolved ultimately. So that adds to the costs to some extent, because you're paying union wages basically for doing that work. So your contractor is dealing with that issue.
So the yes and of that as well is, yeah. If we purchase a already done unit that was built and assembled off-site from somebody else, then you're not doing Davis Bacon Bowley wages.
Right. Okay. It just always leaves me conflicted because I'm pro-union, but then getting around union wages makes nonprofit projects more affordable.
Yeah. And we've paid a lot of union wages in our projects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then one obvious question is, if you got a commercial kitchen and you're cooking, would you work with certain residents on getting their food handler's license?
So. Great question.
Some of them probably already have one.
So we help people get their food handler's license. What I like about our organization is, so here's our mission, right? It's to deepen the mission, and how do we, now that we have this social service hub and we have people, and how do we conceptualize, you know, the vision forward? I am open to collaboration, vision, bringing people up, helping, you know, and so the possibilities are endless, especially if we had a commercial kitchen. It's, you know, what is the, oh my gosh, something boys in LA? Oh, I'll have to get that for you. So there's an organization that does like a step up program for people who want to come in out of shelter and get their food handlers and work in the kitchen and get kitchen experience, because we actually have a lot of folks that are at the shelter and working in our restaurants and in our places downtown. So that has come up, and we've talked about it at the board level, and we've talked about it with, you know, it comes up a lot. So I'm open. And
can I ask a budget question? I had a lot of questions about
this. We're running out of time, but go right ahead.
Well, Linda got a brain dump from me about 11 o'clock last night, so whole bunch of things. Oh God, I shouldn't have said anything. Oh, here we go. So budget question. So there's state money flowing around for various things. I can't keep track of how many various things there are. Linda probably knows. And so there's a whole, it's really hard to keep track of, because it's just sort of, is ORA having to tap into those financial flows through Access as the community action agency? Or are you able to tap into those funding streams directly without going through Access?
Right now, Access is our community action agency. Many of the funds have come through them. We have just been in contact and working directly with the state on, I have to be braggadocious here for a minute, on our excellent reporting on HMIS through the continuum of care.
And tell people what HMIS is.
So it's our homeless information system. So we all have coordinated
coordinated
care. CCOs, but we also have our COCs. And so basically, it's every time we work with somebody, we're entering information into a database that's what drives policy from the HUD level. So. We just are really diligent about each time we serve somebody, getting that information into this homeless information system. So at the state level, they're like, geesh, you've grown up. You know, when you were established, you got this little grant under Access when you're at the resource center. So now, you know, that the talk was about direct funding, but they are our community action agency. We do work with them. And even like we're all working Maslow and Aura and Rogue Retreat, we're all working on, you know, how our county is going to disperse funds. And they would be the agency doing that, you know, because there's only one agency that can.
Right.
And so, yes, they are our primary.
Okay. And who's
we are running out of time.
Who's your main contact representative?
Oh my gosh, Melanie.
Melanie.
Carrie.
Okay. That's all.
Jackie AG.
The last thing.
Thank you very much, Cass. I would just like to request that maybe, as you, so many things have changed since we were there, and also on this committee, we have a lot of new people.
Yes.
So maybe if you'd like to invite us out for another tour. We
I would love to. Can I please invite you out for a tour? And we'll do free elevator rides, too.
That was our last step. We were there just before the elevator
it's
was
working.
Functional. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
We'll take a picture.
Yeah. Congrats on those 140 people in housing. That's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Wow.
Wiggle a little bit. This is always a little tricky because they're in the room, but we need to just make decisions of what our recommendations are to the city council for funding. And we have staff recommendations. Do you want to chat about that, Linda?
You know, I can. I think some of you are new to this process, and it's probably a little confusing, and the breakdown is in the staff evaluation about HUD's rules. These have all these rules. They're not conducive to doing all the things we would like, generally. So I'll just provide this breakdown. The city receives a formula allocation from HUD. Ashland is the smallest entitlement in our entire region, which is called Region 10, and it includes Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. We are the smallest one. Likewise in the nation, there's a couple that are small. So we don't get a whole lot of money. That's what I'm gonna say. And they actually, it was ended up being less than we got last year. So last year, I think we got 188,899. This year, we got 179,575. And for many years, the last couple of years, we got extra money because of COVID. So it was seems like we had a lot of money to help people out and do great things. And we're not getting any extra money right now, as far as I know. So of that 179, we reserve 20% of that for administration of the grant fund. So we keep that to pay me, do things with you. And so that amount is that 35,915. So we pull that amount right off the top. We do have some reprogrammed funds. So the in 2018, we made a special award to Ashland Fire and Rescues. And they did not expend all those funds. It was not really, you know, just mitigating factors. It was a pandemic. They were working in senior homes. It's difficult. So we have taken back $22,228 from that program. We also have just some funding that's going to time out from 2016 to reallocate, which is this $2,283. So we get to add that back in. However, for public service activities, what HUD calls public service, which are direct service activities. So two of the applications we've received, HUD only allows us to spend 15% of our entire allocation for those activities because they prefer capital things. But that means that we only have $26,936 to devote to those sorts of activities.
Is that number again?
$26,936, and that's in this evaluation breakdown, just for your education.
And that includes all the activities from the organizations we just heard the presentations on?
So just navigation and Maslow.
So okay.
So capital can take all the money. You can devote all the money to capital because there is no cap on how much you spend on capital. And the reallocated funding would be put into that bucket too. There's something confusing about how they, anyway, but we won't go into that. So, we have $168,171 we can spend on capital things, unless you remove some of that money
services, then we have less.
You want to know how much less?
Yes.
Okay.
Has everybody figured out what you want? Because I did mine.
Not yet.
And so I would just say that I'm for funding the lunch table here, whatever it is, the
commercial
lunch.
I think your kitchen has a new name. It's the lunch table. I love it.
But so my first thing, I mean, the choice is give nothing to social services, no. Half and half, which is what the staff did. My first relation was to give $25,000 to Maslow and then some version of the rest of the money to ORA. If people want to split it like the staff gave it one option, I'm not against that, but that was my first.
I think staff said they don't care how you split it.
What?
Staff did made no recommendation about splitting it. He said
just
that
said
if
you could
split it. But we actually, I mean, here's the deal that we all know. Like, you guys are all doing great work, and we wish you could fund everything. I mean, there is no, you know, you're both equally matched. I mean, there are times, for those of you who don't know yet, there are times when people come and they do not have good applications, right? Like, they,
right.
You know, or they don't compete well against another application, right? Like, this is clearly something we really, really need, and this is, you know, a need, but maybe not as dire. This is not one of those situations. That's what staff is recommending. This is just not that.
Well, I got derailed. Can I go back a step?
Yep.
So I'm looking at page 11 of, in, I believe that's in the packet as a whole. The PDF, it's the PDF page number. And so I'm looking at the staff recommendation section.
Oh, uh-huh.
Which appears to be on page 11 of the PDF. So you said we could, what was that you said about pulling some money out of the capital project money? That some of that's movable? What? Did I hear you say that?
You can spend all the money that's available, which is 168, 171,
right,
on capital. You can spend it all on capital and not do any public services. That's allowed by HUD. You can only spend 15% on public services, but if you want to spend both public service and capital, that it reduces the amount that you can spend on capital because you're taking the public service money out of that. It's not in addition.
Okay, so that's why I got confused, because I was.
Yeah.
Thinking about some things as separate, but in fact they were kind of linked. Okay, so I was confused.
So I agree with Rich with what he's saying about giving the max to Maslow that we can, basically, because of those restrictions on what goes to services, and that would leave around $146,000 for the capital.
Where did I come up with $141,235?
Or that, it was $25,000 for services. I wrote down
No, the maximum for services is $26,000.
Yeah, $26,000. Okay.
Yeah, so
that would leave
$145,000. So that's what you would do. When I said that,
don't give them more than they ask.
Just give them what they ask.
Yeah, but then there's nothing for ORA then.
Well, ORA is going to get the rest of the money for their capital project, just not for navigation.
But not for navigation, and that's my problem. I mean, I want them to get something for navigation.
That's why we have so much time for this discussion.
Yeah, so you know, we stopped raising hands.
They can only use $5,000 for their navigation.
Bad memory.
So this is moving kind of fast for you new people. Are you on
board? No, I'm getting it. Yeah.
Mostly?
Mostly, yeah.
So I'm going to make a motion. How about that?
You're welcome to.
Okay. And Linda, help me with the right number. So if, because I can't find it really fast on the PDF, and you probably have this number on the surface of your brain. So taking out the 26,936, the maximum 15% that we can from this pot of money. That leaves how much for the capital?
$141,235.
So I am going to move.
Go ahead.
I'm going to move that we do the following three things. That we allocate 141,235 to ORS capital activity, which is not as much as they asked, but it's what I think we can do. And that we split the 26,936 divided by 2.
13,488.
Thank you. And this will get us started for discussion. And that we award OROB for resource navigation the amount of 13,488. And then we recommend to the City Council that Maslow receive 13,488 for wraparound services.
Is there a second? All right, does somebody have a different motion you would like to put forward?
Yes, I'd like, oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I'd like to move that we spend the 141,235 on the capital improvements for ORA, and then spend the remaining 26,936 on services at Maslow.
Is there a second?
Rich, try again. I'm not advocating that they get more than what they asked for. So.
Oh, was that more?
Yeah.
So they asked for 25.
Well, they asked for 25, yeah. And so then that other money could come back to
the ORA. Okay, so if we do that, it would be 143,171 to ORA Capital, 143,171, and then 25,000 to Maslow.
Is that your motion, Kathy?
Yep.
Is there a second on that motion?
I second.
Me.
Yes. Discussion.
I strongly oppose that. I think it's unfair.
You think it's unfair? Do you want to speak about why you think that's unfair?
I think it's unfair to ORA. I mean, I have a soft spot for resource navigators. Having educated one of their best ones. And I know ORA has the ability to tap into multiple funding streams. And so does Maslow. And I'm also just kind of thinking about what we've done in prior years when we've been in this situation in this commission/committee. So when you've got, you know, two equally meritorious applications and limited funding, you know, my sort of default setting based on prior experience is to split that money. But if people don't want to do that, that's okay.
Further discussion.
What was our last year's history of the grants? I can't recall how much.
So last year, Maslow got 25,000. They were the only applicants for public service, and ORA got 128. Is that right?
For capital.
For capital.
And then, but the services were split between Rogue Retreat.
You're right.
And
there was a lot of CARES going last year. Yeah, we had a bunch of CARES Act money. Yeah. So then, did you only get 128 and they only got 21? Oh, I guess that's right, because I didn't have any carryover except for the CARES Act. And then 240,007.
Each of us got, we got 40 from Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and we each got 90,000.
Yeah, but yeah, it was split pretty evenly between Rivers. Thank you for reminding me. And then the year before, Maslow got 25. You generally get 25,000, especially now that they're not competing with St. Vincent de Paul.
Hey.
Is it possible to take some of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund money and put it to the capital or expense?
So we are not offering Affordable Housing Trust Fund money, which is this your question today. We did that last year. So generally we do it every other year because generally we would be doing social service grants right now, which can backfill services, and that a lot of people have relied on that, which is why I asked whether that would be included in the budget, because oftentimes, you know, both of these organizations also apply for that fund, so it helps build back anything they don't get through this process. So next year would be our Affordable Housing Trust Funds, and yes, next year they could apply for that. It's a little bit of a stretch. It supports shelters because mostly
housing trust funds are for housing. Those have a bit for shelter.
It can.
I know everything that's in there.
I know you do.
Easily.
Well, so it, yes, it has a section about shelters can be used for funding shelters that promote a program that is about self-sufficiency, not sort of one-time things. But the lion's share of that money generally has its uses are prioritized for housing.
I just looked at the minutes from a year ago. What we recommended, I'm not sure exactly if it's exactly what the city council passed,
yeah,
but what yeah. we recommended for CDBG monies was 128,266 to ORA, 25,000 to Maslow for school-based services. And then CARES money, extra gravy, we split between ORA, $40,673, and $40,000 to Rogue Retreat for the community shelter. And we kind of know how that turned out. And then we had Affordable Housing Trust Fund money last year, which we now don't have at the moment. And we recommended awarding $60,000 to Habitat for Humanity for those affordable units that are getting constructed at Beach Creek. I'd love to have an update on that. $55,000 to ORA, that might have been for the elevator? Did that come in there?
No, that was services.
Okay, services.
Operations.
And then another $55,000 to Rogue Retreat.
Yep.
So in the 2022 meetings on this, we awarded a ton of money for Rogue Retreat.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be interesting.
Well, they did expend the funding and they fulfilled their contract.
Anyway, so that's a little historical context.
Yeah, can I say something here? The reason I made the motion about doing something similar to what we did historically, it sounds like that's confirmed that's similar, is not that I'm not an ORA fan. I mean, I adore ORA so much. I'm always talking about you guys, and I feel like the fact that Maslow is a smaller nonprofit, to me, they have fewer grant funding and just fewer arms in the community, and maybe that's not true. No. So tell me more.
They have a smaller presence in Ashland, but they're I believe, a comparable organization, a size organization.
Oh, really? Okay. I stand corrected.
I don't actually know what you're...
Yeah.
They have a broad reach. They go all the way there.
And I have a comment?
Yeah. Yes, I'm looking to you for comment.
Sure. We have... Like when I first started, for example, in 2013 and served Ashland School District, I was only part-time, and the Ashland program is now full-time as well, full-time in Ashland. So that program has actually grown here. It's that's the need.
Well, sounds like they're comparable size.
Brittany, it sounded like you wanted to say something, this is your first foray into this.
Just out of strictly fairness, my thought was give Maslow 15,000, give the navigation 11,936, and then the money for the commercial kitchen. That was just out of fairness, because I mean, when I was reading it, and I knew I liked them all, so it was really hard.
That's the part that makes this job
difficult.
So there is a motion on the table. So if you wanted to go that route, we would need to defeat this motion and start a new one, or amend this one.
Or the person who made it withdraw.
Yeah, I withdraw.
Do you want to make a motion?
Wow.
So move. Just say what you just said.
Okay. So move, whatever. Yeah. Okay, my motion is to give Maslow 15,000. This is the navigation 11,936, and the commercial kitchen, is it 141,235?
Is there
yes.
a second?
I'll second that.
All righty, more discussion.
Could we ask Ora which is more important to you?
Right now, I service operating dollars. Last year, we received a $1.4 million CARES Act for operations, and those
thank goodness, right? COVID's over, right? But so we don't get reimbursed. We don't do fee for service for any of our resource navigation. Every dollar comes from grant asks. And again, we went from a $240,000 a year organization to a $2.6 million organization. And so I would say service. It might be easier. It's a lot more sexy to go get a capital ask from a foundation or to ask for those than it is for operating dollars.
Yeah, I noticed you had philanthropic support for the kitchen.
Which lends itself to this motion. So, anybody that is about to vote no want to say something?
I don't know where I'm about to vote.
Okay. Sorry, I may not have said that well.
I guess I like the first recommendation, but to me, the key is that we need unity in our group. And so I always kind of fall down there. And so when I came in, I'm recognizing I will go where the group grows. So I'll go last.
I love you, Rich.
So if I were making a proposal, which I'm not, because there's one already on the table, I would say 25,000 to Maslow, 25,000 for navigation to Aura, and the remainder goes to the capital.
I don't think
we're allowed to do that. We
only can spend 15% of the total on services.
Otherwise, you would almost die.
If they put you in charge of this thing, that would be a grand plan.
Yeah.
Right.
Sorry.
But I don't think that was possible. Are you ready to vote? And understand, we're voting on our recommendation. The city council can do whatever they want to do with our recommendation. But this may or may not be what comes down in the end.
Want to restate Christmas motion?
Yes, please.
Well, actually, yes. I thought we'd restate it.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so Brittany makes a motion to give Maslow $15,000, Aura Navigation $11,936, and the full money, which was $141,235, for the commercial kitchen.
Ready to vote?
Just one question. You added that up, so we don't have any.
Is that?
You don't want to give it to the city council and then have it not add
no,
up.
It's right.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Brittany did her math right. Okay. Thank goodness.
Because
I don't always.
Ready to vote? All those in favor? Aye. Aye. Raise your hand. Opposed?
Oh, wait a minute. Some people did.
I'm going to abstain.
Abstain? Well, if you're going to abstain, you have to raise your hand.
Well, you didn't ask me yet.
I did. I said abstain.
Okay, I abstain.
All right. Did you
vote?
Heidi, are you voting? It's already passed, but you can abstain.
Yeah,
it's
already
passed.
I know. I want more money. That's what I want.
And more money.
And it appears that I don't know that we'll have time to really discuss the next item on the agenda, but it appears that there's a lot of money coming down the pike in the future. We will have different streams than we've had before.
And that's why I wanted to ask that question about access.
So, but that is our recommendation to the City Council. Thank you very much, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the work you do.
Well, thank you guys for the work you do. Wish we could come this way.
Scroll all the way back here.
I don't even know what's going to stop me.
We can go.
Yes. To the beginning. The agenda is. I just want to say congratulations to those of you who are new to this process. It is difficult. It's very hard to make hard decisions.
always to me is hard, it's especially difficult when they're in the room. That's what being a public entity is all about, you know, that's.
In 25 words or less, can you explain the role of access in this whole discombobulated thing?
If you could give me 25 words, I'm going to let Linda speak.
So Access is our community action agency, which gives it a status that allows it to receive certain types of federal funding that is then, or federal and state funding, that is then funneled out to nonprofits through them.
I see.
So, and because of their structure, they are meant to receive those grants within the state.
Right.
And so there is some money that will always go to Access to be distributed from there.
Right.
Cass is right, there is some money that can come straight from the state to CAP or to nonprofit organizations that serve homeless populations, but generally the lion's share of that money goes to community action agencies. And most counties have a community action agency that serves them. Our action agency serves both Jackson and Josephine County. And generally they have things, a few different things, like nutrition programs, weatherization programs, and then some service programs.
And housing.
So they do generally have like a rental assistance program.
Utility assistance, they have a whole fire survivor.
Everything fire survivor.
Right, department. And because it's a structure that exists for the purpose of disseminating funding, like the wildfire money comes down and it makes sense to run it through them.
Okay.
The other thing that they are, which they don't, it doesn't have to be this way, but this is the way it is they are the lead agency for our continuum of care. The continuum of care is a HUD grant and also like a HUD mandated program, but it doesn't have, so any community can identify what organization can be the lead agency. So it's just we chose a long time ago, Access is our lead agency. So the money gets run through them as like a administrative arm. You know, their accounting handles the payments and the contracts.
I think I mostly get that. They had nothing to do with what we did today, though, directly.
No.
They could apply for grants, but they don't necessarily.
Thank you.
Not these kind of.
Thank you for that. Twisted.
They're very big and very complicated.
So, if you don't mind, I think what I would suggest is that we have a little conversation about our the health and well-being of this committee, the next steps for this committee. And Joy has already left us.
I really want to say that.
You didn't see her resignation?
I don't think she sent it to everyone.
I didn't see her.
I thought she did. I'm sorry. Joy resigned effective immediately.
Right.
Just priorities in life.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. I thought she sent it to the whole committee. We have recommended that Crystal be appointed to fill that spot.
Mm-hmm.
We have an existing applicant that didn't get appointed last time. And I'm sad to leave. I just have a lot on my plate right now, and I don't feel like I can do it justice to stay here. My term is up, so yes. We've not just been committing to stay, we're committing another 3 years, and I'm just really happy that I can do that.
6 years is a long time. You are amazing.
I got to say to Linda, it's just, I mean, the appreciation for me and others is so huge. And I thought she set a sort of standard for leadership that I just wanted us to do, was that it was both smart and strategically thought through. It had compassionate values, and she has boots on the ground service. So if we find people with those pieces, not too many of them out there, but
thank you.
That's the standard that we.
Thank you so much. I you'll still see me. I'll still be at all the time when it's time to like, but hold up the signs and protest when it's time to like serve the meals. I'm not going anywhere. As a community person, I just won't be sitting at this table with you. But I appreciate it. So that means my term is not actually up until April, but I'm out of town for that April meeting. But at the April meeting, it would be a good idea to hopefully we will have Crystal added by then. Bob is moving that forward. And if you have another applicant, I think that they're willing to move those forward. But we'll be ready to elect officers. So just start talking amongst yourselves about who that ought to be.
We have a vice for next
month. And she's chairing, you will preside the next meeting. And then and then you will be electing somebody who would start in May to be the chair. How's all that sound?
I'm going to miss you. You're very good at clock watching.
It's a little like her cats.
I understand the need for that. Thank you.
Indeed.
It's not easy to do with this group.
Do you agree about postponing the whole conversation about the coming money?
Yes, absolutely. It is a big conversation. I don't want to give it, you know, short.
But I do want to get the staff report coming up.
Well, I actually, for a minute, do you want to come and join us? Do you feel comfortable introducing yourself?
Sure. I'm Bethany Bowles. I go to Lovegrass Public Charter School, and I'm here job shadowing Linda Reed. I'm hoping to go into something with social work, and it's just such a great opportunity to be here and join you guys' meeting.
Great.
Thank you. How cool. What kind of shadow?
Well, and I thought it would be great for her to come to this meeting, so I am a social worker, but I don't really do the sort of social work that most people think of, and many of us. So we do have other social workers at the table, and I thought this would be a really great opportunity for her to see the public engagement and how we make funding decisions. And also, I think you guys are a great group of people, and I just thought she would enjoy it. I hope it's been enjoyable and interesting. And if you have any questions, I think afterwards you could certainly talk with anyone if you have further questions.
And get a donut.
It was a professor in social work, so.
Well, no, sociology.
Oh, okay.
I imitated doing social work, but I really am not.
No, good connections.
So, beyond that, Cass touched on a couple things that, yes, we have been involved in the executive order around homelessness, and as many of you know, the legislature passed a bill that will fund that work. Off the record, it was a very prescribed process that the state gave us. They estimated that we should receive about $11 million, and then they gave us targets of things they wanted us to do, like numerical targets, like we want you to create 80 new shelter beds, we want you to rapidly rehouse 1,200 households, we want you to do rental assistance for, I can't remember that number, 800 households.
Wow.
And then you tell us how much money that's going to cost you to do that. And we're going to give you a contract, probably in April, and you need to be completed and have your outcomes reported by December 31st.
What?
Yep.
Wow.
Yes. That just, and then so they said.
So we're going to really high gear here.
And then they said, you need to get this pre-filled out application back to us about how you're with your plan for how you're going to do that. We want to see you do community engagement. We want you to involve culturally specific populations and organizations. And we expect you to give us timelines. Don't leave any month blank for how many outcomes you're going to have in every single month.
Are you chatting with your peers in other cities?
We are finally at that point because we're like, well, how are you guys doing this? So we our application, they gave us 2 weeks. They also told us you need to create a multi-agency committee, and it has to have representation from these specific sectors, and you shouldn't have it be too large because you need to keep it nimble, and you need to get us this pre-filled out plan, you know, within 2 weeks. So we turned our plan in, 2 weeks ago. Last Friday, we received the reply from the state, which was, we thought your plan was great. However, you can't do what you said you're gonna do. So they gave us 15 things to fix, but honestly, those things are not that bad. And then they also created a new fund of money, and they said, we're gonna take this out of that, and then you use this other money that has different rules, and that's coming through the Community Action Agency, but you can move that other money over and reprogram it, but tell us how you're going to do that in the timeline. So that application is due March 31st. She said you should meet with your MAC group every day until you get these problems solved.
You know, I'm in favor of all of this. We've been sitting on these issues forever. We got a governor who said we're not going to sit on them anymore. And I know it's a pain, but I really think rather than just standard operating procedure, I think it sounds like we're on a fast track, and that's probably
as long as we're not being set up to fail.
Well, and that's my concern. So the actions that we proposed were, how do we meet these timelines? If you want new shelter beds, like, what does that look like?
And new affordable housing beds are part of that as well.
Well, it depends on where you are in the state, right? Because they're assuming we can rapidly rehouse, and this is their definition of rapid rehousing. You take a homeless person from the street and you put them in a apartment. Or
a built apartment.
Put them in.
Yeah.
There's no.
Well, and that's the thing. First of all, like, A, there's nowhere to put them. Mm-hmm. B, homeless people have lots of barriers generally, and they don't go straight from the street to a rental unit.
Not successful.
Like, yeah, what's in between? So we came back and we said, we can't, if you want us to hit these target numbers, it's going to be $18 million. And they didn't say no, but we do suspect that they'll come back with 15.
Is this coming from Oregon Housing and Community Services?
Yes.
So it's coming from OHCS?
Yes.
Do you talk to Alex Campbell?
He's not a part of this process.
He's not a part of this.
So that the governor's executive order turned it into an emergency, which is where the multi-agency disciplinary or coordination team comes from, and it has to have representation from emergency management, because that's what allows us to spend money fast.
So we have an emergency manager now, right?
Just hire one.
Yeah. The money is 11 to 15 million.
11 to 18.
11
I'm
to 18
still holding
million.
That for $18 million.
That's for Ashland?
No, it's for the whole county.
Oh, Jackson County.
Yeah. Just okay. Jack, not Josephine.
No,
just
Josephine
Jack.
Is part
just
of the ROC. So all the money was funneled through continuums of care, which is that strange HUD structure that I told you about. Access is our lead agency for that, and they have agreed to funnel this money through. Josephine County is part of what's called the balance of state. So everyone who's not in their own continuum of care belongs to the balance of state. And they are called the rural Oregon continuum because most of those are rural counties.
So there's five MSAs, and Jackson County is an MSA. So they're basically
Bedford, Ashland, and
Portland,
counties.
Eugene, Bend,
yeah,
Jackson
Oregon.
County, and Salem.
So we are hearing a little bit from the others. I think that the way the process unfolded and how quickly it unfolded didn't really allow us to do a lot of outreach and feedback. And so that part was really frustrating. And the sections that I submitted for the narrative essentially said, given the time constraints, this is what we came up with.
Like it or not. What role might this committee have?
So what's going to happen next? Theoretically, we got together and we are proposing a variety of things to meet our quick shelter bed turnaround. And what's going to happen is we still need to put out like an RFP, but we don't really have time to do a real RFP process. So we're going to do a letter of interest. That is going to go out tomorrow. So anyone who has any ideas and meets a certain criteria, right, like they are a fiscally viable agency that can do these sorts of activities, has the ability to speak to how we can meet these goals. Those will then be vetted through the MAC group and then potentially move forward with the funding, but not until we get the funding. We just got the contracts from OHCS, template contracts, which aren't the final contracts. I think the role for the city of Ashland and for this group is that we have proposed some actions to take place in Ashland. Obviously, Aura would be a grantee for all of the funding, all of the different types of funding. So they will put in a letter of interest. I think the part that's difficult is to try, I don't know that the Ashland projects will all get funded. I don't actually even know what's going to get funded at all.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Might this funding
be used to pay for that emergency center that Joe wants?
So I have tried to work that in, and I Brandon and I will meet with Joe next week to let him know.
Because that would free up the $1 million that he wants to spend, which is unrestricted money that could go for affordable housing.
Or operations.
Or operations, or many, many things.
I know.
We're producing darn pallet shelters.
So here, well, and I have made a proposal that I also have to run by Joe, which is that we, our pallet shelters will probably get shipped to Rope Retreat and then add 20 beds to the total 88 that we need to create. So our issue is we have to create I think they gave us a weird number there. They create between 68 and 79 new shelter beds. And so I think Rogue Retreat is proposing that they could bring 20 on pretty quickly. We have 20 in the pallet shelter, but they have to be somewhere. And in order for them to count, they have to be somewhere and they have to have access.
What do we get back?
Well, we'll meet this criteria. So that's the part that I haven't figured out yet. I mean, we're maybe going to get some money. I proposed at the MAC group yesterday that so far OHCS and the state is not saying that they will fund the operations for any of these activities beyond this time period. So don't expect more money to keep going whatever you establish, and don't expect more money to keep doing rental assistance, whatever. We're not guaranteeing you anything, even though it is in the budget, like an additional amount of money. My thought is, after January 11th, we can do anything we want with whatever assets we create with this money, so we should create what we want, so we can use it the way we want.
In permanent fashion.
Later.
Yes.
Workforce housing. Yeah.
Workforce housing.
But it has to fit into these three categories now, and then transition into something that we want. So how do we
It's transitional manage? Housing until it becomes workforce housing.
Yep. I know.
But it is not housing. We can't do anything that we don't have the beds, and we don't have the beds.
And that's the discussion we had at the MAC group yesterday.
Not emergency
beds.
It's
the thing
beds,
that we really need is permanent supportive housing.
Yes.
We need to move people. I mean, sure, we can create all the shelter beds in the world, right? And we're just going to keep sheltering people because they can't move out of the shelter.
Yeah. Like, well, but we've got permanent supportive housing that's built and empty. Columbia Care is empty.
It's not empty.
It's all dark every time I drive by there.
They're putting people in there. Do they have staff?
Oh, yeah. They got staff.
Aura's putting people in there right now. They have an agreement to move people in there.
What people were telling me is that they weren't open because they didn't have enough staff.
That was the whole thing. I went in there 3 weeks ago and talked to the staff that are there. And she was telling me that they're bringing in other staff so they're able to do it. And then ORA's got the agreement to send people over. They can probably find
out. So there are actually people living
there. Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
So when I talk to Joe, I will let him know that this is the potential opportunity, but that it won't be an emergency weather shelter until January 11th. It will be an emergency shelter that has to be operated now and have beds. So the thing that we don't have that Medford has is we need locations. I mean, we have a whole list of locations that we've vetted that are actually on the market for sale that we could move forward with right away. I know. And I threw that hat in the ring, and someone is wanting to pick that up, so we'll see how that goes. But the other piece is that we have looked at other locations and vetted them for the emergency weather shelter, which is kind of the thing that Joe has talked with us about. But it would need to be an all-the-time shelter, and it would need to be operated by somebody. But it would fit freed up our $1 million. We could pay them to operate that. Yeah. All the things.
Buckle your seatbelts. This is going to get real interesting.
But I just got to say, I mean, this is great.
In
my mind, I mean, it's a big hassle.
I got $18 million to do stuff with, and we only have to do it until the end of December.
We've waited years to do
one. Right. So. And we can get a lot of money to use it wisely. You know, it's easy to just fast money disappear.
There's been a lot of that, and we had talked about that. Yes, I don't want to fail. I don't want to lock ourselves into a project that we can't complete and have no outcomes that we can report to the state. And they're like, "What'd you do with all the money?"
Am I correct? The last version of the look ahead that I saw has the housing production strategy.
Yeah.
Going to the city council, I believe, on May 2nd, 3rd.
Second.
So how does all of this sort of, is it completely separate from the HPS?
Yeah, completely separate. I mean, the housing bills, which we are going to talk about today, but we'll talk about next month, I think those will have probably some impact on what we're doing with the housing production strategy, but this is essentially the state telling us, we want you to do these three things.
Yep.
And also meet all the needs of your community.
And here's the money for it, for a change.
Can I just throw one idea out there? I don't know if everyone watched the documentary, and I'm just thinking about mobile homes as being permanent affordable housing. And I'm like, at what point can the city of Ashland also look at buying one of the parks and putting that in the budget for permanent affordable housing?
You go, girl.
Go, girl.
Yeah.
Because if you do watch the documentary, it really shows, like, it's there's a predatory market looking to swoop in on this land right now, and why don't we get ahead of that and protect the housing that is affordable in this community right now?
I read the Planning Commission minutes from February when Beth Goodman did the presentation from Eco Northwest to them, because I was curious to see how they were talking about it. And I was actually seeing a fair amount of support from the Planning Commissioners for mobile homes, manufactured homes to be technically correct. And that surprised me a little bit, actually. But I think there is support from people that I ordinarily wouldn't think of as supportive.
Well,
for manufacturer and or modular.
If we change the way that it looks, though, right now with it being privately owned, there's no way to cap that cost. If it's owned by the city or it's cooperative, say it's owned by the city and then the people, the residents then buy it, then it would give them an opportunity to own their land, right? Or cooperatively own it together.
And have control over those escalating space rent costs.
Yes,
because
right.
even with the rent control,
right
the Pines people and those little tiny
yes.
single wives are paying $800 a month.
Yes. Yes.
The next year
it goes up every
rent.
Year.
Yeah.
Every
yeah.
year.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So I would say the city generally is not in the business of buying and selling like residential property. Not that the city doesn't buy property, but that we don't like manage residential properties. But the city could use funding to support an organization or residents in purchasing that. So I think it would just be more
land
cooperatively.
Just, yeah, creative.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
city,
would be amazing.
The city does own land that would be
right.
great. For
use could be used
home.
That way. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
This is real exciting, but it's 6 o'clock, folks.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I say that we're adjourned. Thanks.
Wait,
no.
The
oh.
other idea I have is SOU is in financial
yeah.
trouble, but they have all these dorms that
That's,
are not,
they're going to get demolished.
But before they get demolished,
wouldn't
they
you
be,
like some money?
No.
Could they be refurbished?
No.
They're
unsafe, they're unsanitary, they're contaminated. It's serious.
But they do have all those single family homes.
They do
still.
Have a lot of single family homes.
Yeah. And so,
which
I mean, this is the thing about the MAT group. We had to move too fast. It didn't get representation from everybody. So there are ideas and pieces of property that maybe we could pick up in rehab. I mean, it's a whole list of like.
Yes, I have lots of like.
But the thing was, it's like, we don't have time to meet with all the players and find somebody to manage it and create a real solid plan.
What I must say,
and
my title
wow.
is community and
wow. social liaison. I know, it's terrifying. And I don't want to waste
for,
time. I don't
Oregon
want to
Shakespeare,
so I'm
going to
I brought that up. I was like,
and,
we're timelines that we need to hold people to. I don't think it's going to work out.